Hello and welcome back to Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. Who would have thought this time last week that the South African government would fail to present its annual budget? Its partners in the Government of National Unity and not a few cabinet ministers from the ANC as well, I would have thought, were given a final view of the budget on the morning of Wednesday, February 19th, hours before it was due to be presented. To their horror, Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana told them he was going to announce a massive increase in VAT from 15% to 17%. I'm afraid I have to say it too, that it was widely reported incorrectly and still is being reported incorrectly as a 2% increase in VAT, which is ridiculous and might explain why we so often get our sums wrong here. But you have to feel very briefly for Deputy President Paul Mashatile, who had to preside over the last-minute cabinet briefing because Cyril Ramaphosa's airplane had been delayed. Anyway, Mashatile would have taken one look at the note, at the loud intake of breath around the cabinet table when Godongwana finally revealed the 17% VAT number had been quietly keeping secret and decided he wasn't going to be held responsible for it. So he adjourned the meeting and cancelled the budget. Now an enormous amount of work has to be completed by March 12th. And in the wake of this fiasco, it's been made abundantly clear to the government and the ANC that people are gutful of rising prices and the effect inflation is having on their lives. A few days afterwards, polls showed the ANC share of the vote slumping to close to 30% if an election were held today. And that's a long way of introducing my guest today. Joel Pollack is a conservative American writer and editor, a notable figure in the Make America Great Again movement that swept former President Donald Trump back into the White House last November, a man very familiar with South Africa and is indeed married to a South African, born in South Africa, and who may become the next ambassador to this country. Welcome to this modest podcast, Joel, and I'm especially grateful because I think it's 4 o'clock in the morning for you in Los Angeles, and even more especially because I know you've been up working for some time already. And I know you've done a few South African media interviews since the Trump inauguration, but could I start by just asking you to sketch out your connection with South Africa, obviously being born here, but just if you could just take us through what your parents might have been doing in here and what you did here as a child and why you've kept in a way in touch with South Africa and coming back.
Well, I was born in Johannesburg in 1977, April, and my parents had already been considering a move abroad for a variety of reasons. My father, who was trained at University of Witwatersrand in medicine, was considering a career overseas in the then new field of transplantation, which had some early origins in South Africa, but really took off in the United States. So he wanted to pursue that dream. He also had served in the South African military and had worked in South African townships and became convinced that the country's future was very murky. He did not want to raise kids under what he considered a racist system. So he was looking at opportunities abroad. And on the job search, when my parents were overseas, I was conceived and they came back to South Africa. I was born and then they moved to the Chicago area 8 weeks later. And that's where I spent my childhood, in the suburbs of River Forest, Oak Park, and Skokie. Skokie being a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. And I grew up there with some connection to South Africa. We visited relatives a few times when I was a kid, but South Africa was a difficult place to connect to growing up in the 1980s. It was being watched closely by the entire world, especially in the United States. And if you were a white South African in particular, you didn't really advertise your connection too much. We became citizens in the late 1980s and began to take a revived interest in South Africa around the time of the release of Nelson Mandela in 1990. I remember watching on television as he gave his speech in Cape Town. I actually had some relatives in Cape Town who were at that speech. And my father, who actually has an encyclopedic knowledge of South African history, began to lecture as needed at my public high school in Skokie, because we were reading South African literature like Cry the Beloved Country, and my dad would hold the class in absolute fascination as he explained the incredible history of South Africa, the incredible complexity of the society and the issues there. And so I began following it more closely and listening to Johnny Clegg and all kinds of things. And when I was at university, my final year at Harvard, Nelson Mandela came to Harvard University and spoke, he was awarded an honorary doctorate. He was the third person to be awarded an honorary doctorate outside of the actual graduation season, the two predecessors being George Washington and Winston Churchill. So it was quite a big deal. And it really rekindled my interest in South Africa. So I came to South Africa after I finished my undergraduate degree at Harvard, and I studied at the University of Cape Town as part of a Rotary Foundation ambassadorial scholarship. And I began volunteering in Khayelitsha and really exploring my roots, exploring the country. After about a year, I decided to try to become a freelance journalist and did that for a couple of years, wrote for various publications. My first article was actually for The Big Issue in Cape Town, which is sold by homeless people. I wrote a story about Patricia DeLille.
I think it's probably one of the few surviving print publications left in the country.
Yeah. Did a nice interview with Patricia DeLille, who was then an up-and-coming, interesting former radical who seemed to be moderating somewhat as she made an appeal to a broader electorate. And while I was doing this, I suppose I caught the attention of some people in Tony Leon's office. He was then the leader of the opposition in the South African Parliament, and they offered me a job as a speechwriter. So I took it, and I worked there for 4 years, and it was an incredibly interesting time to learn about South African politics, to be exposed
tell
to
us
it.
Tell us where we are, Joel, more or less. When did you start working for Tony?
I was hired at the end of 2002, and I worked through into the second half of 2006, so just about 4 years.
So by this stage, you'd been in the country for a while. I mean, you'd really familiarized yourself with your home country, I suppose. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, South Africa has so many layers to it. You can never really be an expert in so many different languages and regions and issues. But I became familiar enough to write, at least somewhat competently, I hope, most of the time, and to learn more on the job, really, because part of the job was research. And so I had to learn. And it was amazing, just absolutely fascinating to have a front row seat to the drama that is South African politics, especially at that time when Thabo Mbeki was the president. And economically, you could say the country was at its high point in the post-apartheid era, but the ideological clashes between the ANC and the DA really did set up the debate that I think continues in South Africa over the direction of the country and over its relation to the Constitution and the vision of the Constitution of 1996. And so it was really a transformative period for me. And I came back to the United States after meeting Rhoda's daughter. So Julia came to Parliament. I actually knew Rhoda before I knew Julia because of
just
the business.
Just for listeners, we're talking about Rhoda Kadalia, who we were talking before we went on air about the fact that she was a columnist and quite a scary columnist for me when I was editor of Business Day around about the same time. We had a number of huge fights about what to say. I have to say, I never changed a word she ever wrote, but I did try to persuade her occasionally to tone down what she was saying. But a really good woman, you know, and I was really proud to be her editor at the time. But you married her daughter.
Right. So I knew Rhoda through her columns, actually, for the Business Day, and she would write these incredible columns. And I asked Tony's secretary, Sandy Slack, for Rhoda's number, and I called her. And I would call her every few weeks, and we would just talk about South African politics and about the world, and we became friends, but we actually never met in person. So I didn't know that she had a daughter, and one day she told me, oh, yeah, my daughter got into Harvard, and she's coming to work for the Democratic Alliance at Parliament. And I thought, well, that's great. So I didn't think much of it. But then when I met her, there was kind of an instant attraction. And I thought, okay, this is trouble. So, so it was just a cordial, friendly relationship in the beginning. And we got to know each other over several months. And eventually we started dating. This is about 3 or 4 months into her employment. And it was sort of an office scandal that had a happy ending, because I'm sitting here today in Los Angeles, and we've been married for 15 years and we have 4 kids.
Wow.
And that's the story of Julia. But basically, Julia was on her way to Harvard. And when she left, I was still working for Tony, but I said, I have to pursue this. This is as good as it could. I mean, this is just unbelievable, you know, unbelievable woman and unbelievable opportunity. So I went back to the United States and went back to Harvard, studied law. And we courted until we both graduated from Harvard. She finished her undergraduate degree in economics and I finished my law degree. And we got married in December 2009. And we had the wedding celebration in Cape Town, actually, because most of the guests would have been from South Africa anyway. So bring the wedding to the guests rather than the other way around. Yeah. And the rest is history.
But you fundamentally, you left the country with your new wife to resettle back in the U.S. Did you go directly to L.A. or did you drift around?
So Harvard in the Boston area for three years. And then I was recruited by the Republican Party back in Illinois because I had become somewhat internet famous. We had a member of Congress who was very left-wing named Barney Frank, and he was the chair of the House Financial Services Committee. And he was in charge of rebuilding the American financial sector after the financial crisis of 2008. He came to speak at Harvard at the Kennedy School of Government in the spring of 2009. And Julia and I went there to hear him speak and to ask him questions. And he spent his entire lecture essentially blaming every Republican administration going back to William Howard Taft in the early 20th century for the financial crisis. And so I had some other more technical question I was going to ask him. But then I said, well, Congressman Frank, you were the chairman of the committee during this whole meltdown. I mean, how much of it is your responsibility since you've blamed everybody else? And he absolutely blew up at me. And it became a kind of notorious exchange. But at the time, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, okay, he lost his temper and I, you know, just didn't. And it went on for about 5 minutes or so. And so people found it entertaining, but I just thought it would die there. And I went home and woke up the next day and it was national news because there was a TV camera in the room and they had put it up and it had circulated widely. It had gone viral, you know, in the early days of YouTube and so forth. And soon I was getting invitations to speak on television everywhere. And so I got a call from the Illinois Republican Party saying, would you consider coming back home and running for Congress? So I did. And we lived in the Chicago area for a year or two while that was going on. I lost, but I organized a very active campaign. We raised a lot of money from donors. I mean, I had no money of my own. Yeah. And it really energized many conservative activists in the Chicago area who had previously been dormant. And during the course of that campaign, I got to know Andrew Breitbart, who was then starting out as an internet media entrepreneur in Los Angeles. And when the campaign ended, I came out to Los Angeles and began working for him. I was licensed to practice law by then in California. So I started out as the attorney for his young fledgling company. And then when it began to grow into a real news organization, he said, we need a safe pair of hands to run the company. Why don't you be editor-in-chief? So I was editor-in-chief for 2 years before many things happened. Andrew passed away suddenly, almost exactly 13 years ago, March 1st. Yeah. And he left behind this company, which was about to relaunch. And that's when Steve Bannon moved in. He had been on the board of the company. You may have heard of Steve Bannon. He had been on the board, but he became the executive chairman. And he helped steer us through that period. And Steve and I worked together. The nexus of the company moved from California, where it had started out really writing about Hollywood, politics in Hollywood, because Andrew believed that culture is upstream from politics and really defines our political debates. So it was important to Andrew to cover Hollywood from a political perspective. But we moved the nexus of the company to Washington, D.C., and we did a bit of musical chairs in terms of responsibilities. So I became the senior editor at large, and I've been doing that for just about 12 years now.
Thank you for that. I mean, I think it's a really good grounding for a discussion, because obviously you now get to the point where you're in the news again, as you were. In fact, I think the first time Donald Trump got elected, there's speculation about whether you might become the next American ambassador to South Africa. And I'm looking up some of the old reports. Rhoda Kodaly, your mother-in-law by then, was telling South African journalists to go away and leave him alone because they were obviously bothering you early in the morning. But we'll come to that in a minute. I want to just talk about America for the moment. Joel, I'm interested in and appalled by what Donald Trump seems to be doing in the world in just his first few weeks in office. You know, so I grew up.
Really?
I'll tell you. So I grew up, and you'll recognize the South Africa I grew up in. I'm older than you are, but I mean, you know, I grew up in a small town, went to one of my favorite, one of my favorite things is the bit in the movie Patton, where General George Patton steps up onto that huge stage. I'm sure you've seen it, in front of a giant American flag of stirring music. And he's wearing, you know, he's got the uniform on, pearl-handled revolvers. And it's so macho, you know, and it looks so, I suppose, to me, right in a way. You know, this is a victorious American, saved Europe from the Nazis. What's not to like here? You know, we need the strength in the world. And it just seems that America that I know from here is being taken apart. And I wanted you just to try and explain to us what the plan is, you know. I mean, I get that the President Trump is not a fan of globalization, but I don't really know what it is that he does want. I mean, what is the end of all of this, if it all works, look like? What's the new world look like?
Have you read the text of Patton's speech to the Third Army?
It's very Trumpy. the one where he swears.
Yeah.
No, there's a lot of bad language in there.
I would quote from it, but you'd probably lose your advertisers. I mean, you know, it's
this is an unsponsored.
Well, go ahead. maybe you'll gain some advertisers.
Yeah, well, there we go.
look, Donald Trump is achieving great things, I think, in the first few weeks of his administration. I mean, already he is bringing Ukraine and Russia to the table to end a pointless 3-year war that has gone nowhere. I was very supportive of Ukraine, not just at the start of the war, but for years beforehand. The Democratic Party in this country had the idea for a long time that the correct approach to Vladimir Putin and Russia was to appease them. So when Barack Obama was elected, he and Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, went to Moscow, or he sent Clinton to Moscow, and she infamously pushed the big red reset button, which they had labeled incorrectly because instead of the word reset in Russian, they had written the word overcharge. So it was awkward from the beginning. But there's this infamous photograph of Hillary Clinton pushing the button with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister who still has that job. And the idea was that tensions between the United States and Russia were all the fault of these cowboy Americans, George W. Bush, going around the world acting like he owned it. And we were going to reset relations by being kinder and gentler. So that began. And then Obama immediately gave Putin everything he wanted in terms of nuclear nonproliferation treaties, the New START treaty. And he wanted to do even deeper cuts of our nuclear arsenal, give Putin even more. And this after Putin had already invaded Georgia in August 2008. So Obama took this approach and then acted completely shocked and surprised when Putin invaded Crimea and hurt and wounded. And I'll never forget Secretary of State by then, John Kerry, going on television and saying, Putin is playing by 19th century rules. You just don't do that. You know, who starts a land war in Europe? I mean, you just don't do it. You know, they had not anticipated that he would do it. They didn't understand who they were dealing with. And the Republican position, which had been much ridiculed in the media, turned out to be correct, which is that you have to be tough with Vladimir Putin. That was John McCain's position. And he said so often, and many Republicans agreed. And when Mitt Romney, who ran for president in 2012, said that Russia was our biggest geopolitical threat, Obama infamously insulted him during the debate and said, the 1980s called, they want their foreign policy back. But Romney was right. So was McCain. And it took 6 years into the Obama administration for Obama to realize that his opponent had been correct, but it was too late. Then Trump came in and Putin did nothing for 4 years because Trump, despite being friendly with Putin, was quite firm with him in terms of policy. He imposed sanctions, for example, on Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline. He gave the Ukrainians weapons, anti-tank missiles, instead of meal rations, which is all that Obama sent, warm meals and blankets. That's what he sent to Ukraine. Donald Trump sent anti-tank missiles, Javelin missiles. So Russia didn't do anything for 4 years, didn't invade Ukraine, didn't invade anything else either. And Biden came in and went back to the Obama-Clinton playbook. One of the first things he did when he got into office was he lifted the sanctions on Nord Stream 2, and then he held a summit with Vladimir Putin in Geneva before ever meeting with Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky. So that is the backdrop to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, plus the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan, which Biden mismanaged and led to impressions of American weakness. So I was very supportive of Ukraine. And when Biden was offering Vladimir Zelensky free passage out of the country, they thought Kyiv would fall within 48 hours. I mean, I thought it was ridiculous. And it was great to see Ukraine fight back and defend its sovereignty. But then about 3 or 4 weeks into the war, I wrote a piece saying, now's the time to negotiate, because Ukraine had completely stopped the Russians and it had the momentum. And it was clear it couldn't last. Russia is just vastly larger than Ukraine, has more resources. And the Russian strategy in war has always been, well, I mean, the joke is, you know, settle in and wait for winter, you know, but yes, basically attrition, right? And you want to negotiate from a position of strength. So that was my advice. Nobody listened, obviously, because they have kept fighting and the front lines have barely moved. I mean, Russia's taken a little bit more Ukrainian territory and Ukraine now has a little bit of Russian territory. But essentially, for more than 2 years, the front line hasn't moved. And the conditions of a stalemate have existed for so long that there really should have been negotiations under Biden. And Biden came into office saying, diplomacy is back. America is back. We're going to be diplomatic again. It was, you know, the same thing Obama had said about George W. Bush, that he wasn't diplomatic enough. But there was no diplomacy. And Ukraine was this rare exception where Biden and the entire American foreign policy establishment were willing to spend infinite amounts of money to try to achieve a victory that they would never define. So Trump came into office and said, this ends now. And that's just one example, but he's come in and he's dragging the two sides to the table. Now, whether that agreement can be reached and whether it's good or not is another question. And, you know, there's room for debate on that, but it's clear this was long overdue. And if he has to use a little bit of rough language to get that to happen, that's his style. He uses words carefully, even though he seems, to some at least, to be reckless with words. That's also part of a careful deployment of language to create boundaries around conflict.
I mean, would it have been deliberate to call Volodymyr Zelensky a dictator and a loser and a guy with, what, 4% approval rating? I mean,
yes, and it's important that he did it, and it's right that he did it. I'll tell you
why.
Two reasons. First of all, it is a fact that Zelensky has suspended elections in his country, so you can argue about whether that makes him a dictator or not. But, you know, in the United States, we have elections in wartime. It doesn't matter. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was reelected during the Second World War. So,
but not while parts of your country are being occupied by an invader. Surely, I mean, that makes a difference. You're fighting a war elsewhere.
We had elections during the Civil War. We had elections during the Civil War. The South was occupying the Union. I mean, you have elections. That's the American idea anyway. You know, and maybe it comes from a tradition of always having elections on the first Tuesday in November. You know, we don't have a parliamentary system where elections can be called when you want to call them. I mean, they have to be the first Tuesday of November. So, you know, the American perspective on it is you don't cancel elections for anything. And
people are making a lot of the fact that Winston Churchill didn't hold elections during the Second World War. And there's...
I'm just telling you where Trump is coming from.
Okay.
I mean, But Trump didn't say that before. Why did Trump say that? Because, and this is actually instructive for South Africa. The Ukrainians for many years have had bad political advice. They intervened in the 2016 election in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton, thinking that she would be better for them, even though Obama had been a disaster, and so had she, in terms of Russia policy. And that's the origin of some of the Russia collusion conspiracy theory, was the Ukrainians essentially working with the Clinton campaign to sow doubt about Donald Trump. When Trump became president, things changed, and Trump developed a pretty good relationship with Ukraine, although he also lectured them privately about corruption and so forth. But he then had a warm relationship with Zelensky until Democrats seized on his phone call with Zelensky to try to impeach him and remove him from office. But in 2024, the Democrats and the Ukrainians worked together again, and the Ukrainians made a really terrible mistake, which was to send Zelensky over to the United States during the presidential campaign to campaign with Democrats, because whoever was working with the Ukrainians in the United States must have told them, you know, you need the Democrats to win to keep the flow of money going and so forth. So it was clear that Ukraine had weighed in on the side of the Democrats. Completely inappropriate, okay? And people don't forget that. Then in the early days of Trump's term, when Trump started pressuring Ukraine to come to the table, Zelensky said a number of ill-advised things about Trump, how he didn't understand and Ukraine would never do this and do that. You don't criticize Trump in public because he will criticize you 1,000 times worse than you can criticize him. And he does this to make sure that people listen to what the United States wants. And he has to do it. Otherwise, they will completely ignore him. Ukraine has played a double game, by the way. They've taken American money and American weapons, but they've also tried to deal with China to move closer to the One Belt, One Road system of trade that's dominated by China. And Trump is deeply concerned about Chinese influence in Ukraine and elsewhere. So he is signaling to Zelensky, you don't play that game and you don't use the media to do it. The media in the United States, as far as political commentary and positioning and so forth, has been completely discredited. I mean, the American media as an institution, completely discredited. And if you try to play this game where you're going to accuse Trump of misinformation, or you're going to try to say that he's wrong, and you're going to try to use the media to drive that message home, you've instantly lost credibility with the American public. And that's what Zelensky did. So Trump had to attack him to bring him into line and say, you are coming to the table, you are going to sit down with Putin, and you're going to accept compromises. That's the only way forward here. And he had to insult Zelensky to do it, because Zelensky actually insulted him first. So likewise in the South African situation, when Trump commented on South Africa, you don't then accuse Trump of misinformation. I mean, you know, people in the media can say what they want, but the president of South Africa and senior officials and so forth, you don't accuse Trump of misinformation. You don't say that he's acting irrationally. You don't do that. That's exactly the wrong thing to do. You try to understand where he's coming from. You offer compromises and you get to a better place. And often when he has these arguments with people, they often end up in a much better place than they were in the beginning in terms of policy. But it was absolutely necessary for Trump to behave that way. And
can I just stop you there? So did you watch Emmanuel Macron talking to Donald Trump in the Oval Office?
I listened to it. I didn't watch it on video, but I listened to it.
Would he have handled, by, you know, the measure of what you're telling me now about how to treat Donald Trump, would he have handled him correctly, do you think?
Macron is very good at saying the right thing in person. You know, if you watch his conduct on the world stage, he had a very unnecessary fight with Israel, where he was very kind to Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, after the October 7th attack. But then he said a number of things when he went back to France, which deeply wounded the relationship between France and Israel. And I wouldn't exactly adopt him as a paragon of great behavior, but he did say some important things. I mean, Macron's response to Trump's proposals was positive in that he said that what Trump was doing was important and correct. And he wanted to drive home the message that we had to be careful. I think those were his words. Be careful what you're offering in terms of compromise to Russia. And I think Trump heard it. And if you heard Trump's responses to Macron, Trump talked about how wonderful it was that the Notre Dame Cathedral was rebuilt so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, he was congratulating Macron. I don't know if Macron had anything to do with it personally, but yes, you did see a warmth there between the two leaders. And I think Macron basically gets it. But, you know, if he had laid into Trump at the press conference, you would have seen Trump respond very differently.
For sure. So just generally, though, I mean, and I understand, you know, there are lots of aspects to this. There's domestic, there's Europe, there's South Africa. But is there a, you know, whatever the result in the Ukraine might be, not the Ukraine, but Ukraine might be, how would you just briefly describe the world that Donald Trump wants to see resulting from his presidency? I mean, at the end of it, you know, will NATO still exist? Will Will the notion of the West still exist? I mean, I accept that these things might change, or is he intent on ending those things and replacing them with others? I mean, you know, if you appoint Pete Hegseth, for instance, as your Secretary of Defense, and let's, you know, we're both in the media business. I it's not a job that I don't, well, I think that I would be qualified for. I've done my, you know, I've done a little time in the military. Or Tulsi Gabbard as Chief of Intelligence. How do they help Donald Trump get to where he wants to get in the world? I mean, how do they help reshape the world better rather than somebody who might be a more experienced soldier or a more experienced intelligence officer? I'm not saying you have to disagree with Trump. I'm just saying why these
people... First of all, the experienced crowd in Washington, D.C. has done a pretty shocking job. I mean, the withdrawal from Afghanistan was handled by the best and the brightest, the veterans of decades of service in government bureaucracies. So there's a real lack of trust at the moment in the experts, so-called, in a variety of fields, science, military, government. And given that so much of the mischief, and it really was during the first term where people were leaking documents and undermining Trump policies, given that it came from the so-called deep state, that is to say the almost permanent civil service, Trump did not want to recruit from the ranks of so-called experts and experienced people. He wanted reformers, outsiders with some experience. I mean, Pete Hegseth is a combat veteran. And Tulsi Gabbard, who's the director of national intelligence, is also a veteran of the army. But look at Tulsi Gabbard. She was a left-wing politician, to the left, really, of Hillary Clinton. She supported Bernie Sanders in 2016. And she was outspoken in her views against Hillary Clinton. And for that reason, she was kicked off the Democratic National Committee, or she resigned. But essentially, she was pushed to the margins of her party. And she opposed her party's support for foreign intervention, and as a result began gravitating toward the Trump camp because Trump said he wanted to end foreign wars. That's the vision. It's not about NATO existing or not existing. Those are means to an end. The end for Trump is a more stable, peaceful world, and one where American interests are achieved. But she was, for some reason, put on a terrorist watch list, despite having served in the military for decades and still serving. I think she was in the Army Reserve right up until recently. And if she isn't already, I think she has to give that job up to take on the intelligence role. But, you know, she had been unfairly targeted by the defense and intelligence establishment, the same people who spun the Russia collusion hoax, the same people who tried to entrap Trump over this Ukraine phone call back in 2019.
Yeah.
So in a sense, there's a bit of assigning the victims of government abuse to run the agencies that abuse them. And there's a sense of justice in that, but there's also a sense of appointing people who are motivated to make changes. And you can see that at the FBI as well. Kash Patel, he started out as a completely not ideological guy. He discovered that Democrats had abused intelligence powers to spy on fellow Americans in order to invent the Russia collusion hoax. And Adam Schiff, Democratic congressman who yep. once chaired the House Intelligence Committee, now he's my senator from California, but Adam Schiff hated Kash Patel for exposing the scheme and pursued him relentlessly for years. They investigated him, they spied on him, they opened criminal investigations, they never found anything because he was innocent of everything, and they tried to destroy him. And now he's in charge of the investigative and law enforcement agency that they tried to use against him. So it's not about political revenge, but it is about reform, because those same experienced and credentialed insiders whom you refer to, they're not only bad at their jobs collectively, I'm sure some are very good, but they also abused their power. They had been in charge for far too long, and that is the reason he's appointing them.
You know, I mean, you mentioned putting the victims in charge of things. That's exactly what's happened in South Africa, obviously. The victims of apartheid now run the country. And the results aren't all that pretty, as you pointed out yourself.
Well, you can't be a victim forever, right? You have to overcome your sense of victimization and do a good job. I mean, if Kash Patel does a bad job, or the Department of Defense, you know, if we have military missions falling apart again, then Pete Hegseth will be on the way out. I mean, Trump does not hesitate to fire people, but yeah, I mean, I take your point. Victimization is not something you want to wallow in, but it is something that has to lead to justice.
Yeah. Just to stick a little bit longer with America and Donald Trump, I don't understand the fixation on tariffs and trade. Surely it's obvious that high tariffs will be inflationary. I mean, how does MAGA or the president deal with that? Is it just a passing thing? Because if inflation rises, then obviously, unless he interferes with the Fed, which he's highly unlikely to do, but the Fed would raise interest rates. That's what they've always done when prices rise, which would mean that the dollar would strengthen, which would mean that American exports would become more expensive.
So it's not obvious.
Okay.
So
yes.
Like you, I have a bias toward free trade and against tariffs. And when Trump raised tariffs in his first term, I wrote criticizing that because I thought it was going to lead to higher prices. Well, it didn't actually lead to higher prices. And there was no inflation as a result of Trump's tariffs in his first term. Now, if you look very carefully at individual prices, there were a few that went up, but overall price levels didn't rise. But at the same time, foreign policy results did improve. Trump used the threat of tariffs, for example, in his first term to convince or coerce, however you want to look at it, the Mexican government into stopping the flow of migrants to the border. So Mexico deployed thousands of troops along its southern border to prevent people from walking up from Central America and crossing the border illegally into the United States. So that was a new use of tariffs that people hadn't considered, that tariffs can be a nonviolent method of foreign policy persuasion. And that is how Trump is still using tariffs.
That, I can see that applying to Mexico. How does it apply to Canada? I mean, Canadians seem to be perfectly happy where they live.
Well, first of all, it's not about Canadians migrating across the border. It is about people abusing the long and unguarded Canadian border to move fentanyl and to move migrants across the border. There is some of that. And there's also a sense that Canada takes advantage of the United States. I mean, especially in agriculture, there's a sense of that. So partly it's an economic issue and a border security issue. But also I think that Trump prefers to move North America together in a particular direction. So for example, in his first term, when he renegotiated NAFTA, most Americans, when they think about the problems with the North American Free Trade Agreement, they think about Mexico, jobs leaving for Mexico. But Trump didn't just say to Mexico, I'm going to raise tariffs unless we renegotiate the agreement. He said it to Mexico and Canada. And he moved all three countries toward a new agreement, the U.S.-Mexico Canada agreement. So that's how he prefers to move. He doesn't really like to single out one country or another, although he does enjoy calling Justin Trudeau the governor of Canada.
I've noticed.
You know, that's a way of getting under his skin. Well, you know what? Again, there you go. That's another example of responding to Trudeau. Trudeau insulted Trump first. There's an infamous video in Trump's first term of Trudeau mocking Trump at some meeting of international leaders. And Trump, I don't think, is inclined to let Trudeau forget it. And he knows Trudeau's on the way out. His approval is in the basement. You know, it's just through the floor. And Trump wants to work with a more pro-American, pro-market, and helpful Canadian prime minister who's likely to be a conservative in the next elections. So I think Trump is trying to shape outcomes without directly intervening in Canadian elections. He's trying to let Canadians know that he does not have any regard for their current leadership. Yeah. And by the way, nor do they.
I mean, so the attitude towards allies is interesting. I mean, the Canada is clearly, well, has been up until now, clearly an American ally, as of most Western European countries, the Brits, the Germans, the French. And I wonder whether, you know, it can't just all be about the amount of money they spend on defense, particularly if you take J.D. Vance's speech in Munich recently. I mean, it's about values. He highlighted the instance of the British police arresting this fellow who was praying outside an abortion clinic in protest, obviously at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, okay, you know, but what's it got to do with America? What's it, you know, so what? I mean, it's not an American issue.
It's a huge American issue. Massive.
Yeah. I understand that. No, I know, but it's not.
I mean, not just
in
abortion. No. But the European Union has tried to crush free speech in this country, not just in Europe. They've tried to regulate American companies and American commentators, and they've threatened Elon Musk, who owns Twitter, now X. And the moment Europe tries to do that, America has a problem with it, and rightly so. And I think J.D. Vance sent a very clear message that Europe cannot count on the support of the United States if it does not honor freedom of speech. There's no more fundamental freedom, and Americans do not want to send billions of dollars to defend Europe if Europe is attacking one of the most fundamental values. You know, we don't bother so much with what they do on their own. Although it's somewhat shocking that you can be arrested and prosecuted in Germany for, you know, online insults and that kind of thing. But once you start threatening American companies, which they've done,
yeah,
there's no you've completely destroyed American support for defending Europe. Why should we risk our lives and spend our money to defend a country that's attacking our basic value? Look, the issue of freedom of speech in Europe is fundamental because Americans do not want to be obligated to defend the continent. Number one, if it doesn't share our values, but number two, especially if it's attacking our own freedom, and that's the perception. You had another question before we got to that point about Europe, and I don't want to run past it, but I don't remember what it was.
No, I was just simply bunching the Europeans into the number of allies that Trump seems to be, or that America seems now to be happy to make uncomfortable, to insult, to call out for things that don't necessarily have much to do with America.
Look at Germany. Speaking of insult, I mean, there's a famous clip, you can find it online, where Trump is speaking at the United Nations, and he tells Europe that it needs to be less dependent on Russian gas. This is before the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And the camera cuts to the German delegation sitting in the General Assembly and laughing at Trump. Trump was 100% right. Europe could not threaten Russia and keep Russia out of invading Ukraine because the Germans especially were dependent on gas from Russia.
Yeah.
And so, again, they mocked him. They laughed at him. He was right. The invasion happened. So, you know, there's a deep commitment, and you could see it with President's remarks next to Macron. There's a deep commitment to European security if Europe is on our side, if Europe is willing to do the things necessary to defend itself. Macron said, you know, France needs to spend more on defense. That's what Trump wants. He's not threatening NATO because he doesn't like NATO. He's threatening NATO because he feels that these companies are basically free riding on American expenditure.
Yeah.
That America is spending all this money to defend Europe and Europe's not doing anything. That has changed since Trump threatened NATO with withdrawal and so forth, and people started spending more on defense. But I think the United States is committed to Europe, but it needs to understand that Europe is worth defending, in a sense that Europe's not going to become an enemy by siding with Russia or by allowing China in, which Ukraine was inclined to do, and by attacking American freedoms. So that's the approach.
So let's just move on to South Africa. And I want to just read to you from an essay that somebody who I'm sure you'll know, Bill Johnson, R.W. Johnson, has just published about Donald Trump. In the middle of the essay, basically, so now we have the whole Trumpian agenda in full stream. Trump seems drunk with power and self-love, and at least for now, is getting his own way almost unchallenged. Out goes gender politics, out goes DEI, whole large agencies of government are being shut down on a whim, and so on. But what does it all amount to? Like so many populist movements, Trumpism is focused on a myth of the golden past. So he's promising to bring back yesterday. America will be made unchallengeably great again, as in the Eisenhower period. Globalization will be reversed, as will affirmative action, gender politics, and any number of liberal initiatives in government. Immigration will be slowed to a virtual halt and white Americans will remain the majority. Women will no longer be allowed to a leading role in the military and trans people will have no role at all. Traditional gender roles will be affirmed. But of course, he says, you can't really bring back yesterday. This was the theme of The Great Gatsby. Jay Gatsby thinks he can bring back the past when he and Daisy were young. And indeed, everything that Gatsby's done since then has been predicated on that huge bet. So is Donald, so I don't know whether you follow R.W. Johnson's writing on South Africa, but he's you know, highly regarded in certain circles, in conservative circles in South Africa. Is there a romanticism about what Donald Trump is trying to do? And, you know, to pull America back to the kind of values that he recognizes, you know, where you can't claim to be a woman if you were born a man, or where you can't, you know, where he wants to, in other words, he's restoring older values rather than making up new ones. Is he right?
First of all, Bill Johnson is a very smart guy, but he also predicted that Cyril Ramaphosa would never be president of South Africa because he wasn't a Zulu or a Xhosa. So, you know, not always right, you know, okay? So deep insights and penetrating ones, but, you know, we all have our blind spots. Donald Trump is not drunk with power. Donald Trump is carrying out the agenda he was elected to pursue. And I've been actually quite gratified by much of what he's done, because much of what he's done are things that I suggested. I'm not saying he's doing them because I suggested them, but if you look at the book I published in August 2024 called The Agenda, What Trump Should Do in His First 100 Days, he's doing almost all of it. And voters knew what they were getting. This is not a man drunk with power. This is a man with an agenda for change, a sweeping agenda. And why? Because he was unfairly targeted, because he was prosecuted on ridiculous charges, because they stripped his freedom of speech, because they tried to bankrupt him. And he overcame all of that and won handily. He won the popular vote. And he won also saying, I'm going to erase all of this horrific stuff that has been done to the country. I mean, you mentioned men and women and deciding it can't be some other gender. You can decide to be whatever gender you want, but you can't impose that on other people in the sense that you're going to now erase the idea of biological difference and that men are going to participate in girls' sports or hang around in ladies' locker rooms and pretend to be female. You know, there are some things that are so common sense that it's not Trump imposing some kind of earlier, older set of values. I mean, Trump is basically just restoring reality. The changes Trump is making on transgender policy are overwhelmingly supported by the American public. And the problem was people didn't speak up against it because of a stifling political correctness that was imposed by the Biden administration, by the Democrats, and by social media companies and the news media working hand in hand. Biden violated the American Constitution by essentially delegating the job of censorship to these private companies and threatening them if they didn't. So Trump is pushing back against that. And when he says make America great again, you know, every successful social and political movement in history, just about, has hearkened to some past to identify values that they want to see in the future. But that doesn't mean you're bringing people back to the past or older. You know, the idea is certainly very futuristic. I mean, Trump talks all the time about space exploration. He's the one who invented the Space Force, which is now fully part of the American military. He speaks admiringly about technology. He talked about artificial intelligence before just about any other politician. Trump was talking about the need for massive amounts of new energy to fund all the AI that's going to have to run things, because without energy, you can't run AI. The computing power it needs is so incredible. And he was doing that and people mocked him. And then they realized he was right. So it's not about going back to some, you know, this is the Democratic Party's attack on Trump. He wants to take us to the 1950s. And, you know, they have this image somehow that the domesticity of the 1950s is something horrible and horrific. You know, that's getting deep into feminist ideology, which looks like the 50s that way. But he really is, when he talks about making America great again, he's talking about restoring a sense of confidence that Americans haven't felt since the 1980s, maybe the 1990s during Bill Clinton, when he eased off of some of the left-wing ideology of his party and allowed the free market to flourish and America was very prosperous. And you know, people remember the 80s and after the recession, I suppose, the 90s, as a time of self-confidence and a positive outlook, not just about the country, but about their own lives. And that was interrupted by September 11th and the Iraq War and the recession, and then the cultural battles that Barack Obama brought with him to office unnecessarily, completely unnecessarily. And I think people want to get back to a feeling.
Yeah.
It's a feeling, not a set of old values or whatever. It's really a feeling that they're moving somewhere positive and that they have hope for their families. That's it.
Gerald, talk about South Africa for a moment. So you may be offered the job of ambassador in Pretoria. Would you take it if it were offered to you?
I would.
And well, why? Let me ask you another question. I mean, the other appointment that he has to make regarding Africa is an Undersecretary of State for Africa. Would you take that job if you were offered it? Which would you rather do?
I'm not a State Department bureaucrat, so that's not my path. Okay. I mean, I'm not generally someone who hovers around Washington looking for jobs. Yeah. But if you are asked to represent your country, I mean, it's you know, of course I would, because I have an interest in South Africa and actually a love for South Africa. So I would take the ambassadorial role. Yeah. But I'm not looking for a position for its own sake. I'm sure they'll find the best person for that job.
Watching him act now in Europe makes you wonder what's going to happen in South Africa. How did you feel about his statements about land expropriation in South Africa, the subsequent executive order cutting some forms of U.S. aid to South Africa? Do you think they were justified? It was a remarkable thing to do so early in his presidency. He had the whole world to pick from, you know, in terms of issues, Russia, China, whatever. But there was little South Africa down there at the bottom of the steps after he'd come off Air Force One or one of his airplanes, being given a real workover by the new U.S. president. And I just wondered what you thought of all of that and whether you thought what he did was justified.
I do think what he did was justified. As with many Trump statements, I was surprised that he focused particularly on the land issue and Afrikaner farmers, because that is not where most people go when they talk about South Africa. But the more I considered it, the more I realized that it was rather brilliant. Because what Trump did in that executive order was he undid a kind of quiet consensus around how to address South Africa that has existed over the last 30 years. And I think the United States in particular has treated South Africans, particularly white South Africans, as if they deserve whatever comes to them. And they have to endure not just changes, which I think many in South Africa have adapted to and accept and understand, but they have to endure a certain kind of abuse, or if not abuse, they have to endure a kind of decline in government services and even in the quality of private services. And they have to sit there and endure it, because that's sort of the price of a transition. And we're not really going to pay their complaints much attention. We're not going to give them special access to immigration visas. We're not going to really listen to them. And Trump undid all of that. And he said, okay, now we've heard you. Farm murders are unacceptable. Threats of expropriation are unacceptable. You know, on the one hand, the ANC says, oh, the Expropriation Act isn't actually expropriating anything. And then they say, on the other hand, you know, we have a land imbalance in this country and we have to address it. I mean, which is it? You know, choose. Because you can't tell Trump he's wrong and then do exactly what he says you're doing. So Trump has actually heard the criticisms, I think, that have really largely gone unnoticed for historical reasons. And what he's told the South Africans, you know, I saw Ambassador Ibrahim Rasool saying, before this whole back and forth developed, saying that although he anticipated having some difficulty with the Trump administration, in the end, the Americans would come around because they need our minerals. They need our rare earth minerals. They need our resources. And what Trump is saying is, the resources we care most about are your people and your skills. What's in the ground is important, but we can get it elsewhere. We can get it in Ukraine. We can get it in Arkansas. We can get it where we find it. But what's most important are your people. And by focusing on that, I think he really highlighted the problem with the South African government, if I can be so bold, which is to say that South Africa's government doesn't serve the people anymore. And for many people in South Africa who vote for the opposition, but happen to live in provinces where the opposition will never take power, democracy doesn't mean anything because you vote and then you get the same bad government you had before. So I think Trump has shifted the focus finally to where it belongs, which is the South African government actually serving the South African people? And I think South Africans have been asking that for a while and been trying to find different ways of doing it. And where they could, they've elected opposition parties. And now there's a coalition at the national level and people are trying that. And let's see where that goes. But I think Trump is saying, you have to actually understand that that's your most valuable resource, not what's in the ground. It's what's above the ground. And look at the other issues Trump talked about in that executive order. He talked about Iran. He talked about Israel. News from South Africa doesn't usually make headlines in the United States, but the headline that dominated news from South Africa over the last year and a half was the ICJ case. You may agree or disagree, but effectively South Africa sided with bloodthirsty terrorists on the world stage and said that a country that is brutally attacked by these monsters doesn't have the right to fight back. And in fact, South Africa did argue explicitly that there is a justification for terrorism in international law. Now, there isn't, but that's what the South African legal team argued. And so Americans were shocked by that, actually. Keep in mind, the American reporting on the Middle East is very different from what Europeans see and what South Africans see. And again, we can quibble, we can get into that issue, but the most important thing to understand is that Americans are 80% pro-Israel. And Elon Musk, who is close to the president, personally visited communities in Israel where you could still see the wreckage of the buildings and the blood on the floor. So understand that Americans are shocked by South Africa's behavior on that issue. They're shocked by South Africa welcoming Iran into the BRICS institution when Iran has been funding all of this terrorism, not just against Israelis, but against Americans. Iran has been funding the Houthis who are trying to shut down Red Sea shipping. Why would you do that? It's unbelievable to us, actually, and appalling. I mean, you said you were appalled by Donald Trump's foreign policy. Americans actually want nothing to do with a South Africa that behaves that way. So in an executive order about land expropriation and Afrikaners and so on, there are those points about Iran and Israel, and Trump is also upset that South Africa is moving closer to China. I mean, you know, if South Africa wants to go over to the Chinese side and endure a kind of colonialism that's worse than anything ever experienced under at least British colonialism. I won't say anything about Belgian colonialism, which was pretty bad. But, you know, if you want to do that, okay. But Trump doesn't want China to have influence over the southern part of Africa any more than it already does. And that has an impact on the United States. And I think that what South Africa needs to do is not to try to convince Trump he's wrong or to make fun of him. Or I saw cartoons of Trump as a Nazi, you know, deeply offensive, but whatever. It just shows that there's a kind of refusal to grapple with the opportunity that Trump's actually providing South Africans, which is to have a real conversation about both the foreign and domestic policies of the country. And I think what South Africa needs to do is come to the table with Trump with compromises and say, okay, we're going to amend the Expropriation Act. We're going to drop the ICJ case. We're going to re-examine our relations with China and Russia and Iran and so forth. And then we'll talk. We'll talk about how we can create a better relationship. Maybe we can renegotiate our trade relationship. Maybe we can save AGOA. Maybe we can save our participation in AGOA. But maybe we can even come up with a bilateral treaty between the United States and South Africa that puts us on a better footing. I mean, all kinds of things are possible if you're willing to compromise. But if you just think that you're going to talk past Donald Trump, then it's not going to work. And you'll be in the same box that Vladimir Zelensky found himself in.
So Cyril Ramaphosa has always fancied himself as a bit of a negotiator himself. And I think he's spoken about doing a deal with Donald Trump. How does he begin to try to do that? Because obviously meeting Trump is now difficult because of what's transpired. We've had two instances now where Secretary of State for the Treasury and Secretary of State and Marco Rubio have not come to South Africa for G20 meetings. Do you think this can all be repaired by the time the G20 summit, to which Donald Trump will be invited, comes around in November?
It can be, certainly, because I don't think Trump is asking South Africa to do anything that's particularly difficult, especially because most of what he's asking South Africa to do is actually in South Africa's interest. I mean, amending the Expropriation Act is not just good for American investors. It's also good for South African investors. So why not do it? I mean, you've got the DA taking it to court. Obviously, some South Africans have a problem with it. And it should be done. I mean, that's not difficult. You know, it's not a big ask, even though these issues are very important. The changes are doable. And what I think that South Africa should do is say, okay, we are going to compromise the following things. We're not going to give Trump everything he wants, but look, let's start a conversation. We'll back off of 1, 2, and 3. And we hope that he will then respond. And I think he will. I think he will. I think that's how you get into the conversation. But more than that, I think that's how you get to a better place in terms of American policy.
And is Ebrahim Rasool the right man to have in Washington at the moment, do you think?
Well, I don't really have an opinion on that one way or another. I will say that he's been criticized in the American media for his support for Hamas, which is explicit. I mean, he advertised that he had an autographed scarf from the leader of Hamas, who was then assassinated in Tehran by the Israelis, presumably. In that sense, he's an appropriate representative because he represents the South African government's policy on the world stage. So Americans are offended by it, but on the other hand, we can't go around being offended by everybody sent by every country. Countries send representatives who represent their policies, and that's what you have to deal with. So he is actually a fair representation of the South African government, like it or not.
Joel, I've so enjoyed talking to you. I've got one final question, and it goes back to Russia and Ukraine. And it sort of sticks out like a sore thumb to me. And it is one of the things I think that Cyril Ramaphosa did very well when he tried to negotiate between Russia and Ukraine. It was a failure all around. But one of the points that he made, and it hardly ever gets brought up, and it's not been brought up by the Trump administration, is the number of Ukrainian children that have been taken back into Russia. I mean, I don't want to use the word kidnapped or whatever it might be, but they've been taken back into Russia, put into various forms of adoption or fostering. And that seems to me really outrageous and something that shouldn't stand. Why is there no American voice raised against that? Why can we not hear one?
I think there have been, certainly from Congress, there's been a lot of criticism of that.
The administration.
Well, I don't know that they are concerned right now with taking positions, even if they're morally correct positions. Right now, their focus is on bringing the two sides to the table. I mean, the United States has been criticized for voting on some General Assembly resolution that was critical of Russia. I think the United States took the pro-Russian position. That's not because Trump wants to excuse what Russia did or forget that Russia invaded Ukraine. It's just that he's focused on a different set of problems, which is how do we get the two sides together to make compromises? And I think in that situation, you don't bring up every single issue that you might otherwise bring up. I'm sure that issue will come about or come up in negotiations because it's obviously very important to the Ukrainians. But, you know, Truman had to deal with Stalin.
Yeah.
So
yes.
it didn't mean that Truman started praising Joseph Stalin's human rights record. But maybe when you sit down at Potsdam or whatever, you set those things aside and try to find the common ground. So I think that's where Trump is on this right now.
As I think of my final, this really is the last question. So I've been reading European conservatives writing about Trump, and they're all appalled by what he said about Zelensky being a dictator. I'm thinking of Douglas Murray. I'm thinking of Niall Ferguson. People of some caliber. Who I would rate, and I'm sure you would as well. But they've been outraged by what Trump did to Zelensky, or what he said about him. And, you know, I take the point you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, that this is Trump's way of herding all the cats into the same room.
Right.
But, wow, hasn't he done some real damage in the process?
No, he hasn't. Douglas Murray's a smart guy, and you can criticize Trump. Trump supporters criticize Trump all the time, and they do it because they hope he hears them. And sometimes he changes what he does, and sometimes there are reasons for what he does. I mean, in his first term, Trump reposted some post that was critical of Muslims in Britain, and I spoke out about it, and I didn't agree with it. I thought he was speaking far too broadly, and it was somewhat offensive. And, you know, Trump's critics love that I said that. I got an interview on MSNBC on TV because I, you know, criticized Trump, and they wanted to amplify that. But, you know, you can criticize Trump all the time. I mean, Trump is a big boy, okay? And he's a guy who understands that people are going to be critical of him. And he also understands that sometimes your best friends are going to be the ones who are most honest with you. But I found Trump supporters, you know, in my coverage of the 2016 election, 2024 election, you find Trump supporters all the time who disagree with him about things.
Okay.
Because sometimes he's wrong and sometimes he's trying things out for the first time.
Yeah.
But I think let's wait and see what happens with the negotiation.
Yeah.
It is shocking that Trump is the first world leader to try to bring these two in a serious way to the table. You mentioned Ramaphosa, the former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who was briefly in charge in Israel. He tried to negotiate between the two as well. But basically, none of them had the ability to deliver anything.
Yeah.
And so Trump is doing what he's doing. And I'd like to see a deal that is very strong in protecting Ukraine's sovereignty and the security of Europe. But we'll see. We'll see what happens when we get there.
Yeah. And Joel, look, if you do come here as ambassador, I hope you carry on speaking out and speaking as clearly and as emphatically as you do now before your appointment. And I hope that when you do, if you do come to South Africa, that we see a lot of you in public. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time and respect for the hours that you are up working. Man, I have been up working at 4 o'clock for a very long time. It's been fascinating to talk to you, and I hope listeners have enjoyed it as well. I'll be back next week. Until then, stay well and keep safe. Bye-bye.